confessed, even though I haven't done much lately that deserves blessing. Then he looked at her more closely. Aren't you well, Sophronia? He asked her. Your face seems very drawn.
The heat, perhaps, she said,
passing a slow hand across her eyes. Sit here, he said, pointing at his marble bench. It's the coolest place in all of Jirok. He smiled sardonically, which isn't saying all that much, I'll grant you. She sat on the bench, and Flute clambered up beside her. Well, Sparrok, Vorin said, clasping his friend's hand. What brings you back to Jirok so soon? Did you leave something behind, perhaps? Nothing I can't live without, Sparrok replied dryly. Vorin laughed. Just to show you how good a friend I am, I won't tell Lilius that you said that. Hello, Curic. How's Azalade?
She's well, my lord Vorin.
And your sons? You have three, don't you?
Four, my lord. The last one was born after you left Deimos.
Congratulations, Vorin said. A little late, maybe, but congratulations all the same.
Thank you, my lord.
I need to talk with you, Vorin, Sparrok said, cutting across the pleasantries, and we don't have much time. And here I thought this was a social visit, Vorin sighed. Sparrok let that pass. Has Vanyan managed to get word to you about what's been going on in Samira? The lightly ironic smile faded from Vorin's face, and he nodded seriously. That's one of the reasons I was surprised to see you, he said. I thought you were going to Baratta. Did you have any luck there? I don't know how lucky it was, but we found out something we're trying to track down. He clenched his teeth together. Vorin, he said darkly, Alana was poisoned. Vorin stared at him for a moment, then swore. I wonder how long it'd take me to get back to Samira, he said in an icy voice. I think I'd like to rearrange Anius just a bit. He'd look much better without his head, don't you think?
You'd have to stand in line, my lord Vorin, Curic assured him. I know at least a dozen other people with the same idea.
Anyway, Sparrok went on, we found out that it was a Rendorish poison, and we've heard of a physician in Debauer who might know of an antidote. That's where we're going now. Where are Kalten and the others? Vorin asked. Vanyan wrote that you had him and some knights from the other orders with you.
We left them in Medel, Sparrok replied. They didn't look, or act, very Rendorish.
Have you heard of a Dr. Tangen in Debauer? The one who's reputed to have cured the king's brother of some mysterious ailment, of course. He might not want to talk about it, though. There are some shrewd guesses going around about how he managed those cures, and you know how Rendors feel about magic.
I'll persuade him to talk about it, Sparrok told him.
You might wish that you hadn't left Kalten and the others behind, Vorin told him. Debauer's a very unfriendly place right now.
I'll have to manage alone. I sent word to them from Cypria to go back home and wait for me there.
Whom did you find in Cypria that you could really trust enough to carry messages for you?
I went to the abbot of that Arcian monastery on the east side of town. I've known him for a long time.
Vorin laughed. Is he still trying to conceal the fact that he's a Cyrenaic?
Do you know everything, Vorin?
That's what I'm here for. He's a good man, though. His methods are a little pedestrian, but he gets things done.
What's happening in Debauer right now? Sparrok asked. I don't want to walk in there with my eyes closed.
Vorin sprawled on the grass near Sophronia's feet and hooked his hands about one knee. Debauer's always been a strange place, he replied. It was a Shan's home, and the desert nomads think of it as a holy city. At any given time, there are usually a dozen or so religious factions all fighting with each other for control of the holy places there.
He smiled wryly.
Would you believe that there are 23 tombs there, all purporting to be the final resting place of a Shand? I strongly suspect that at least some of them are spurious, unless they dismembered the holy man after his death and buried him piecemeal.
Sparrok sank to the grass beside his friend. This is just a thought, he said, but could we throw some clandestine support to one of the other factions and undermine Arisham's position?
It's a nice idea, Sparrok, but at the moment there aren't any other factions.
After Arisham received his epiphany, he spent 40 years exterminating all possible rivals. There was a bloodbath in central Rendor of colossal proportions. Pyramids of skulls dot the desert out there. Finally, he gained control of Debaur, and he rules there with an authority so total that he makes Othar of Zemok look like a liberal. He has thousands of rabid followers who blindly follow his every lunatic whim. They roam the streets with sun-baked brains and burning eyes, searching for any infraction of obscure religious laws. Hordes of the unwashed and lice-ridden and only marginally human rage through the streets in search of the opportunity to burn their neighbors at the stake.
That's direct enough, Sparhawk said. He glanced at Sophronia. Flute had dipped a handkerchief into the fountain and was gently bathing the small woman's face with it. Peculiarly, Sophronia had her head laid against the little girl's shoulder as if she were the child. Arisham has gathered an army, then, he asked Vorin.
Vorin snorted. Only an idiot would call it an army. They can't march anywhere because they have to pray every half hour, and they blindly obey even the obvious misstatements of that senile old man. He laughed harshly. Arisham sometimes stumbles over the language, which isn't surprising since he's probably at least half baboon. And once, during his campaigns back in the hinterlands, he gave an order. He meant to say, fall upon your foes, but it came out wrong. Instead he said, fall upon your swords, and 3 whole regiments did exactly that. Arisham rode home alone that day, trying to figure out what had gone wrong.
You've been here too long, Vorin, Sparhawk laughed. Rendor's starting to sour your disposition.
I can't abide stupidity and filth, Sparhawk, and Arisham's followers believe devoutly in the sanctity of ignorance and dirt.
You're starting to develop a fine flair for rhetoric, though.
Contempt is a powerful seasoning for one's words, Vorin admitted. I can't say what I think openly here in Rendor, so I have plenty of time to polish my phrases in private.
His face grew serious.
Be very careful in Debaur, Sparhawk, he advised. Arisham has a couple of dozen disciples, some of whom he even knows. They're the ones who really control the city, and they're all as crazy as he is.
That bad?
Worse, probably.
You've always been such a cheerful fellow, Vorin, Sparhawk said dryly.
It's a failing of mine. I try to look on the bright side of things. Is anything happening in Cypria I ought to know about?
You might want to look into this, Sparhawk said, plucking at the grass beside him. There are some foreigners going about there trying to encourage the belief that the peasantry in the Aline kingdoms in the north are on the verge of open rebellion against the church because they support the goals of the Ashandist movement.
I've heard some rumors about that, Vorin said. It hasn't gone very far here in Jirok yet.
It's just a question of time until it does, I think. It's fairly well organized.
Any idea of who's behind it?
Martell, and we all know for whom he works. The whole idea is to stir up the city dwellers to join with Arisham in an uprising against the church here in Rendor, at the same time that the aristocracy is gathering in Krellos to elect a new archprelate. The church knights would have to come here to put the fire out, and that would give Annius and his supporters a free hand in the election. We've passed the word to the militant orders, so they should be able to take steps. Sparhawk rose from the grass. How long is your servant likely to take to run his errand? He asked. It might be better if we were gone when he came back. He may not be too bright, but I know Rendors, and they like to gossip.
I think you've got a little time left. Gentle's fastest pace is a leisurely saunter. You'll have time to eat something, and I'll give you some fresh supplies.
Is there any safe place to stay in Debaur?
Sophronia asked the sardonic man.
No place in Debaur is really safe, Sophronia, Vorin replied.
He looked at Sparhawk.
Do you remember Perrain?
He asked. Lean fellow, almost never talks?
That's him. He's in Debaur posing as a cattle buyer. He goes by the name Merilek, and he's got a place near the stockyards. The desert people need him, unless they want to eat all their own cows, so he has more or less the free run of the city. He'll put you up and keep you out of trouble.
Vorn grinned a bit slyly.
Speaking of trouble, Sparhawk, he said, I'd strongly advise you to get out of Jirok before Lilius finds out that you're back.
Is she still unhappy? Sparhawk said. I thought that she'd have found someone to comfort her by now.
I'm sure she has, several probably, but you know Lilius, she holds grudges.
I left her full title to the shop, Sparhawk said a bit defensively. She should be doing very well by now if she pays attention to business.
The last I heard, she was, but that's not the point. The whole thing is that you said your farewells and left your bequest in a note. You didn't give her the chance to scream, weep, and threaten to kill herself.
That was sort of the idea.
You were terribly unkind to her, my friend. Lilius thrives on high drama. When you slipped out in the middle of the night the way you did, you robbed her of a wonderful opportunity for histrionics.
Vorin was grinning openly. Do you really have to pursue this?
I'm just trying to give you a friendly warning, Sparhawk. All you'll have to face at Debauer are several thousand howling fanatics. Here in Jirok, you'll have to face Lilius, and she's much, much more dangerous.
Chapter 21 They left Vorin's house quietly about a half an hour later. Sparhawk looked closely at Sophronia as they mounted their horses. Although it was scarcely past noon, she already looked weary. Could this thing that's after us stir up a water spout on the river? He asked her. She frowned.
It's hard to say, she replied. Normally I'd say no, there's not enough open water. But the creatures of the underworld can overcome some natural laws if they choose.
She thought a moment.
How wide is the river here? She asked.
Not very, he replied. There's not enough water in the whole of Rendor to make a wide river.
The river banks would make it very hard to direct a spout, she said thoughtfully. You saw how erratically the one that destroyed Mabin's ship was moving.
We'll have to chance it then, he said. You're too exhausted to ride all the way to Debauer, and it's going to get hotter as we ride south.
Don't take unnecessary chances just for my sake, Sparhawk.
It's not entirely for your sake, he told her. We've lost a lot of time already, and going by boat is faster than riding. We'll stay close to the riverbank in case we need to get off the boat in a hurry.
Whatever you think best, she said, slumping slightly in her saddle.
They rode out into the teeming street, where black-robed nomads from the desert mingled with the more brightly garbed city dwellers and the merchants from the northern kingdoms. The street was filled with noise, and with those peculiarly Rendor's scents, spices, perfumes, and the pervading odor of smoking olive oil.
Who's this Lilius? Kirik asked curiously as they rode down along the street towards the river.
It's not important. Sparhawk replied shortly.
If this person is dangerous, I'd say that it's fairly important for me to know about it.
Lilius isn't dangerous in that particular way. We're talking about a woman, I gather.
It was obvious that Kirik did not intend to be put off. Sparhawk made a sour face.
All right, he said. I was here in Jirok for 10 years. Vorin set me up in a little shop where I went by the name Makra. The idea was that I could drop out of sight so that Martell's hirelings couldn't find me. In order to keep busy, I gathered information for Vorin. To do that, I needed to look like all the other merchants on that street. They all had mistresses, so I needed one too. Her name was Lilius. Satisfied?
That was quick. The lady has a short temper, I take it.
No, Kirik. She has a very long one. Lilius is the kind of woman who nurses grudges.
Oh, that kind. I'd like to meet her.
No, you wouldn't. I don't think you'd care for all the screaming and dramatics.
That bad?
Why do you think I slipped out of town in the middle of the night?
Do you suppose we could drop this?
Kirik started to chuckle.
Excuse me for laughing, my lord,
he said. But, as I recall, you weren't exactly brimming with sympathy when I told you about my indiscretion with Talon's mother. All right, we're even then. Sparhawk clamped his lips shut and rode on, ignoring Kirik's laughter. The docks that jutted out into the muddy flow of the Ghoul River were rickety affairs, and they were draped with smelly fishnets. Dozens of the wide-beamed riverboats that plied the stream between Jirok and Debauer were moored to them. Dark-skinned sailors, clad in loincloths and with cloths wound about their heads, lounged on their decks. Sparhawk dismounted and approached an evil-looking one-eyed man in a loose-fitting, striped robe. The one-eyed man stood on the dock, bawling orders at a lazy-looking trio of sailors aboard a mud-smeared scow. "Your boat?" the knight asked.
"What of it?"
"Is it for hire?
That depends on the price."
"We can work that out. How many days to Debauer?"
3, maybe 4 days, depending on the wind."
The captain was assessing Sparhawk and the others with his good eye. His surly expression changed, and he smiled an oily smile.
"Why don't we talk about the price, noble sir?" he suggested.
Sparhawk made some pretense at haggling, then dipped into the pouch of coins Vorin had given him, and counted silver into the riverman's grimy hand. The man's single eye came alight when he saw the pouch. They boarded the boat and tethered their horses amidships as the three sailors slipped their hawsers, pushed the boat out into the current, and raised the single, slanted sail. The river was sluggish, and the stiff onshore breeze blowing in off the Arcian Strait pushed them upstream against the current at a goodly speed. "Watch yourselves," Sparhawk muttered to his companions as they unsaddled their mounts. "Our captain appears to be an independent businessman, with his eye open for opportunities." He walked aft to where the one-eyed man stood at the tiller. "I want you to keep as close to shore as you can," he said.
"What for?"
The captain's lone eye became suddenly wary. "My sister's afraid of water," Sparhawk improvised. "If I give you the word, put your boat up against the bank so that she can get off."
"You're paying," the captain shrugged. "We'll do it any way you like."
"Do you run at night?" Sparhawk asked him. The captain shook his head.
"Some do, but I don't. There are too many snags and hidden rocks for my taste. We moor up against the bank when it gets dark."
"Good. I like prudence in a sailor. It makes for safer journeys, which brings up a point." He opened the front of his robe to reveal his mail coat and the heavy broadsword belted at his side. "Do you get my meaning?" he asked. The captain's face clouded with chagrin.
"You have no right to threaten me on my own boat," he blustered.
"As you said before, I'm paying. Your crew looks a little undependable to me, Captain, and your own face isn't one to inspire trust." The captain's face grew sullen.
"You don't have to be insulting," he said.
"If I've misjudged you, I'll apologize later. We have certain valuables with us, and we'd prefer to keep them. My friends and I will sleep on the foredeck. You and your men can sleep aft. I trust that won't inconvenience you too much."
"Aren't you being a little overcautious?"
"Nervous times, neighbor. Nervous times. Remember, when we tie up to the bank for the night, keep your men on the aft deck and warn them against sleepwalking. A boat can be a very dangerous place for that sort of thing, and I'm a light sleeper." He turned and walked back forward. The riverbanks on either side were covered with thick, rank vegetation, though the hills rising behind those narrow strips of green were barren and rock-strewn. Sparhawk and his friend sat on the foredeck, keeping a careful eye on the captain and his sailors, and watching for any signs of unusual-looking weather. Flute sat astride the bowsprit, playing her pipes while Sparhawk spoke quietly with Sophrenia and Kirik. Sophrenia already knew the customs of the country, so Sparhawk's instruction was directed primarily at his squire. He cautioned him about the many minor things that could be taken as personal insults, and about other things that were considered sacrilegious.
"Who made up all these stupid rules?"
Kirik demanded. "Ishand," Sparhawk replied. "He was crazy, and crazy people take great comfort in rituals."
"Anything else?"
One other thing. If you should happen to encounter any sheep, you have to step aside for them.
Say that again?
Kirik's tone was incredulous. It's very important, Kirik.
You're not serious.
Deadly serious. Ashand was a shepherd when he was a boy, and he used to go absolutely wild when someone rode through his flock. When he came to power, he announced that God had revealed to him that sheep were holy animals and that everyone had to give way to them.
That's crazy, Sparhawk, Kirik protested.
Of course it is. It's the law here, though.
Isn't it strange how the Aline God's revelations always seem to coincide exactly with the prejudices of his prophets,
Sophronia murmured.
Do they do anything at all like normal people? Kirik asked.
Not many things, no. As the sun went down, the captain moored his boat against the riverbank, and he and his sailors spread pallets on the aft deck. Sparhawk rose and went amidships. He laid his hand on Farron's neck.
Stay awake, he told the big roan. If someone starts creeping around in the middle of the night, let me know about it.
Farron bared his teeth and shifted around until he was resolutely facing aft. Sparhawk patted his rump familiarly and went back forward. They took a cold supper of bread and cheese, then spread their blankets on the deck.
Sparhawk, Kirik said after they had settled down for the night.
Yes, Kirik?
I've just had a thought. Are there many people riding in and out of Devour?
Usually, yes. Arisham's presence there tends to attract large crowds.
I sort of thought so. Wouldn't we be a little less conspicuous if we got off this boat a league or so this side of Devour and joined one of the groups of pilgrims riding into the city?
You think of everything, don't you, Kirik?
That's what you pay me for, Sparhawk. Sometimes you knights aren't too practical. It's a squire's job to keep you out of trouble.
I appreciate that, Kirik.
No extra charge, Kirik said.
The night passed uneventfully, and at dawn the sailors cast off their moorings and raised the sail again. They passed the town of Cottle about mid-morning of the following day, and sailed on upriver towards the holy city of Devour. The river between towns was heavily traveled. There seemed to be no organized pattern to the traffic, and the boats occasionally bumped into each other. Such incidents were usually accompanied by an exchange of curses and insults. It was about noon on the fourth day when Sparhawk went aft to have a word with the one-eyed captain.
"We're getting fairly close, aren't we?" he asked.
"About 5 more leagues," the captain replied,
moving his tiller slightly to avoid an oncoming boat.
"Mangy son of a 3-legged donkey,"
he bellowed at the steersman of the other vessel.
"May your mother break out in warts,"
the steersman replied pleasantly.
"I think my friends and I might want to go ashore before we actually reach the city," Sparhawk said to the captain. "We want to look around a bit before we meet any of Arisham's followers, and the docks are likely to be watched rather closely."
"That might be a wise move," the captain agreed. "Besides, I get a feeling that you might be up to no good, and I'd rather not get involved."
"It works out for both of us then, doesn't it?" It was early afternoon when the captain put his tiller over and drove the prow of his boat up onto a narrow strip of sandy beach.
"This is about as close as I can get you,"
he told Sparhawk.
"The bank gets marshy just up ahead."
"How far is Devour from here?" Sparhawk asked him.
4, maybe 5 miles.
"Close enough, then." The sailors ran the gangway out to the sand from amidships, and Sparhawk and his friends led their horses and their pack mule down to the beach. They had no sooner disembarked than the sailors pulled in the gangway and pushed the boat out into the river with long poles. Then the captain maneuvered his craft out into the current and moved back downriver. There was no exchange of farewells.
"Are you going to be all right?"
Sparhawk asked Sophronia. Her face was still drawn, although the dark circles under her eyes had begun to fade.
"I'll be fine, Sparhawk,"
she assured him. "If we lose too many more of those knights, though, you won't be, will you?"
"I don't really know," she replied. "I've never been in this exact position before. Let's go on to Devour and talk with Dr. Tangen."
They rowed up off the beach through the scrubby bushes that bordered it and soon reached the dusty road that led to DeBauer. There were other travelers on that road, black-robed nomads for the most part, with their dark eyes afire with religious fervor. Once they were forced to the side of the road by a herd of sheep, the herders, mounted on mules, rode arrogantly and deliberately blocked the road as much as possible with their animals. Their expressions clearly dared anyone to object.
"I never liked sheep very much," Keurig muttered, "and I like sheep herders even less."
"Don't let it show," Sparhawk advised him.
"They eat a lot of mutton down here, don't they?"
Sparhawk nodded.
"Isn't it sort of inconsistent to butcher and eat a sacred animal?"
"Consistency is not one of the more notable characteristics of the Rendorish mind." As the sheep passed, Flute raised her pipes and played a peculiarly discordant little melody. The sheep suddenly grew wild-eyed, milled for a moment, then stampeded across the desert with the sheep herders in frantic pursuit. Flute covered her mouth with a soundless giggle.
"Stop that," Sophronia chided.
"Did what I think happened happen?" Keurig said in amazement.
"I wouldn't be at all surprised," Sparhawk said.
"I really like that little girl, you know?"
Keurig was grinning broadly. They rode on at the tail end of the crowd of pilgrims. After a time, they crested a low hill and saw the city of DeBauer spread out below them. There were the usual white-plastered houses clustered near the river, but beyond them, stretching in all directions, were hundreds of large black tents. Sparhawk shaded his eyes with one hand and scanned the city. "The cattle pens are over there," he said, pointing to the eastern edge of town. "We should be able to find Perrain there somewhere." They angled down the hill, avoiding the buildings and tents in the southern section of DeBauer. As they began to ride through a cluster of tents pitched between them and the pens, a bearded nomad with a brass pendant set with a bit of glass hanging on a chain about his neck stepped out from behind a tent to bar their path.
"Where do you think you're going?" he demanded.
He made a quick, imperious gesture with one hand, and a dozen other black-robed men came out into the open with long pikes in their hands.
"We have business at the cattle pens, noble sir," Sparhawk replied mildly.
"Oh, really?"
the bearded man sneered.
"I see no cows."
He looked around at his followers with a self-congratulatory smirk, as if terribly pleased with his own cleverness.
"The cows are coming, noble sir," Sparhawk told him. "We were sent on ahead to make arrangements."
The man with the pendant knit his brows, trying hard to find something wrong with that.
"Do you know who I am?"
he demanded finally in a pugnacious tone of voice.
"I'm afraid not, noble sir," Sparhawk apologized. "I haven't had the pleasure of making your acquaintance."
"You think you're very clever, don't you?" the officious fellow demanded. "All these soft answers don't deceive me in the least."
"I wasn't trying to be deceptive, neighbor," Sparhawk said, with a slight edge coming into his voice. "Merely polite."
"I am Ulsum, favored disciple of Holy Erisham," the bearded man said,
striking his chest with his fist. "I'm overwhelmed by the honor of meeting you," Sparhawk said, bowing in his saddle.
"That's all you have to say?"
Ulsum exclaimed, his eyes bulging at the imagined insult.
"As I said, Lord Ulsum, I'm overwhelmed. I hadn't expected to be greeted by so illustrious a man."
"I'm not here to greet you, cowherd. I'm here to take you into custody. Get down off your horses."
Sparhawk gave him a long look, assessing the situation. Then he swung down from Farron's back and helped Sophronia to dismount.
"What's this all about, Sparhawk?"
she whispered as she lifted Flute down. "I guess that he's a minor bootlicker trying to assert his own importance," Sparhawk whispered back. "We don't want to stir anything up, so let's do as he says."
"Take the prisoners to my tent,"
Ulsum commanded grandly after a moment's hesitation. The favored disciple didn't seem to know exactly what to do. The pikemen stepped forward threateningly, and one of them led the way towards a tent surmounted by a drooping pennon made of dirty green cloth. They were roughly shoved into the tent, and the flap was tied down. Keurig's expression was filled with contempt.
"Amateurs," he muttered. "They hold those pikes like shepherd's crooks, and they didn't even search us for weapons."
"They may be amateurs, Keurig," Zephrenia said softly, "but they've managed to take us prisoner."
"Not for long,"
Keurig growled, reaching under his robe for his dagger.
"I'll cut a hole in the back of the tent, and we can be on our way."
"No," Sparhawk said quietly. "We'd have a horde of howling fanatics on our heels in about 2 minutes if we did that."
"We're not just going to sit here,"
Keurig asked incredulously. "Let me handle it, Keurig." They sat waiting in the stifling tent as the minutes dragged by. After a bit, the tent flap opened, and Ulsum entered with two of his men close behind him.
"I will have your name from you, cowherd," he said arrogantly.
"I am called Makra, Lord Ulsum," Sparhawk replied meekly, "and this is my sister, her daughter, and my servant. May I ask why we have been detained?"
Ulsum's eyes narrowed. "There are those who refuse to accept Holy Arisham's authority," he declared. "I, Ulsum, his most favored disciple, have taken it upon myself to root out these false prophets and send them to the stake. Holy Arisham relies upon me completely."
"Is that still going on?" Sparhawk asked in mild surprise. "I thought that all opposition to Arisham had been stamped out decades ago."
"Not so, not so," Ulsum half-shrieked. "There are still plotters and conspirators hiding in the desert and lurking in the cities. I will not rest until I have unearthed every one of these criminals and consigned them to the flames."
"You have nothing to fear from me or my band, Lord Ulsum," Sparhawk assured him. "We revere the holy prophet of God and pay him homage in our prayers."
"So you say, Makra, but can you prove your identity and satisfy me that you have legitimate business in the holy city?"
The fanatic smirked at his two cohorts as if he had just scored a tremendous point. "Why, yes, Lord Ulsum," Sparhawk replied calmly. "I believe I can. We are here to speak with a cattle buyer named Miralek. Do you perhaps know him?" Ulsum puffed himself up.
"What would I, the favored disciple of Holy Arisham, have to do with some common cattle buyer?"
One of the disciples' toadies leaned forward and whispered at some length in Ulsum's ear. The disciple's expression grew less and less certain, and finally, even a bit frightened.
"I will send for this cattle buyer you mentioned," he declared grudgingly. "If he confirms your story, well and good, but if not, I will take you to Holy Arisham himself for judgment."
"As the Lord Ulsum wishes," Sparhawk bowed. "If you would have your messenger tell Miralek that Makra is here, with greetings from his little mother, I'm sure he'll come here immediately and clear up this whole matter."
"You better hope so, Makra,"
the bearded disciple said threateningly. He turned to the toady, who had whispered in his ear.
"Go and fetch this Miralek. Repeat the message of this cowherd to him, and tell him that I, Ulsum, favored disciple of Holy Arisham, command his presence immediately."
"At once, favored one,"
the fellow replied, and scurried from the tent. Ulsum glowered at Sparhawk for a moment, then he and his other sycophant left the tent.
"You've still got your sword, Sparhawk," Keurig said. "Why didn't you just let the air out of that windbag? I could have dealt with the other two."
"It wasn't necessary," Sparhawk shrugged. "I know Perrain well enough to know that by now he's managed to make himself indispensable to Arisham. He'll be here shortly and put Ulsum, favored disciple of Holy Arisham, in his place."
"Aren't you gambling, Sparhawk?" Sophronia asked. "What if Perrain doesn't recognize the name Makra? As I recall, you were in Jarak, and he's been here in Debower for years."
"He may not recognize the name I go by here in Rendor," Sparhawk replied, "but he can't fail to recognize yours, little mother. It's a very old password. The Pandians have been using it for years."
She blinked. "I'm very flattered," she said, "but why didn't someone tell me?"
Sparhawk turned to her in some surprise. We all thought you knew. It was perhaps a quarter of an hour later when Ulsom escorted a lean, saturnine man in a striped robe into the tent. Ulsom's manner was obsequious and his expression worried.
"This is the fellow I was telling you about, honored Merilek," he fawned.
"Al Makra," the lean man said, coming forward to take Sparhawk's hand warmly in his own. "So good to see you again. What seems to be the trouble here?"
"A slight misunderstanding is all, Merilek," Sparhawk replied, bowing slightly to his fellow Pandian.
"Well, that's all straightened out now." Sir Perrain turned to the favored disciple. "Isn't it, Ulsom?"
Of course, honored Merilek."
Ulsom faltered, his face visibly pale now. "Whatever possessed you to detain my friends?" Perrain's tone was mild, but there was a slight edge to it.
I'm only trying to protect Holy Erisham."
"Oh, and did he ask for your protection?"
"Well, not in so many words."
"I see. That was very brave of you, Ulsom. Surely you know how Holy Erisham feels about those who act independently of his instructions. Many have lost their heads for taking too much upon themselves."
Ulsom began to tremble violently.
"I'm sure he'll forgive you when I tell him of the incident, however. A lesser man would be sent to the block immediately, but, after all, you're his favorite disciple, aren't you? Was there anything else, Ulsom?"
Mutely, his face pasty white, Ulsom shook his head.
"My friends and I will be going then. Coming, Makra?"
Sir Perrain led them from the tent. As they rode through the city of tents that had grown up on the outskirts of Debour, Perrain talked at length about how depressed the cattle market currently was. The tents they passed had apparently been pitched at random, and there was nothing resembling a street. Hordes of dirty children ran and played in the sand, and dispirited-looking dogs rose from the shady side of each tent they passed to bark indifferently a few times before returning to flop down out of the sun again. Perrain's house was a square, block-like structure that stood in the center of a patch of weedy ground just beyond the tents.
"Come inside," the knight told them loudly as they reached the door. "I want to hear more about this cattle herd of yours."
They went in and he closed the door. It was dim and cool inside. The house had but a single room. There were rudimentary cooking facilities on one side and an unmade bed on the other. A number of large, porous jugs hung from the rafters, each seeping moisture which dripped into puddles on the floor. A table and two benches sat in the middle of the room.
"It's none too ornate," Perrain apologized.
Sparhawk looked meaningfully at the lone window at the back of the house, a window that seemed only loosely shuttered.
"Is it safe to talk?"
he asked in a low voice. Perrain laughed.
"Oh yes, Sparhawk," he replied. "In my spare time, I've been nurturing a thorn bush outside that window. You'd be amazed at how much it's grown and how long the thorns are. You're looking well, my friend. I haven't seen you since we were novices."
Perrain spoke with the faintest trace of an accent. Unlike most Pandians, he was not an Elenian, but came instead from somewhere in the vast reaches of central Eosia. Sparhawk had always liked him.
"You seem to have learned how to talk, Perrain," Sophronia said. "You were always so silent before."
He smiled.
"It was my accent, little mother," he said. "I didn't want people making fun of me."
He took her wrists and kissed her palms in greeting and asked her blessing.
"You remember Curic?" Sparhawk said.
"Of course," Perrain replied. "He trained me with the lance.
Hello, Curic. How's Aslaid?"
"Very well, Sir Perrain," Curic said. "I'll tell her you asked. What was that business back there all about? With Ulsom, I mean."
"He's one of the officious toads who've attached themselves to Erisham."
"Is he really a disciple?"
Perrain snorted.
"I doubt that Erisham even knows his name," he said. "Of course there are days when Erisham doesn't even know his own. There are dozens like Ulsom, self-appointed disciples who go around bothering honest people.
He's probably 5 miles out into the desert by now, and riding very hard to get away. Eresham is very firm with people who overstep what little authority he gives them. Why don't we all sit down?
How did you manage to accumulate so much power, Perrain? Sophronia asked him. Ulsan behaved as if you were some king or something.
It wasn't really too hard, he replied. Eresham has only 2 teeth in his head, and they don't meet. I give him a tender, milk-fed veal every other week as a token of my unspeakable regard for him. Old men are very interested in their bellies, so Eresham is profuse in his thanks. The disciples aren't blind, so they defer to me because of Eresham's supposed favor. Now, what brings you to Debower? Vorin suggested that we look you up, Sparhawk said. We need to talk with someone here, and we didn't want to attract too much attention. My house is yours, Perrain said ironically, such as it is. Who is it you need to talk with?
A physician named Tangen,
Sophronia told him, removing her veil. Perrain looked at her rather closely. You are looking a bit unwell, Sophronia, he said. But couldn't you find a physician in Jirok? She smiled briefly.
It's not for me, Perrain, she told him. It has to do with someone else. Do you know this Tangen?
Everybody in Debower knows him. He keeps quarters in the back of an apothecary shop in the central square. His house is being watched, though. There are rumors going about that he dabbles in magic sometimes, and the zealots have been trying to catch him at it. It might be better to walk to the square, wouldn't you say? Sparhawk asked. Perrain nodded. And I think we'll wait until just before the sun goes down. That way, we'll have some darkness when we come out, just in case we need it.
You want me to go with you?
It might be better if Sophronia and I went alone, Sparhawk replied. You have to stay here, and we don't. If Tangen's under suspicion, visiting him could jeopardize your position here in Debower.
Stay out of alley, Sparhawk,
Curic growled. Sparhawk motioned to Flute, and she came to him obediently. He put his hands on her shoulders and looked directly into her face. I want you to stay here with Curic, he told her. She looked at him gravely, then impudently crossed her eyes at him. Stop that, he said. Listen to me, young lady, I'm serious.
Just ask her, Sparhawk, Sophronia advised. Don't try to order her around.
Please, Flute, he implored. Will you please stay here? She smiled sweetly, put her hands together in front of her, and curtsied.
You see how easy it is, Sophronia said.
Since we've got some time, I'll fix you all something to eat, Perrain said, rising to his feet.
Did you know that all your bottles are leaking, Sir Perrain?
Curic said, pointing at the dripping vessels hanging from the rafters.
Yes, Perrain replied. They make a mess on the floor, but they help to keep it cool in here.
He went to the hearth and fumbled for a few moments with flint, steel, and tinder. He built up a very small fire of twigs and twisted chunks of the branches of desert shrubs. Then he set a kettle on the fire, took a large pan, and poured oil in it. He set the pan on the coals and took several chunks of meat out of a covered bowl. As the oil began to smoke, he dropped the meat into the pan.
I'm afraid it's only mutton, he apologized. I wasn't expecting company.
He spiced the sizzling meat liberally to disguise its flavor, then brought heavy plates to the table. He went back to the fire and opened an earthenware jar. He took a pinch of tea from the jar, dropped it into a mug, and poured hot water from the kettle into the mug.
For you, little mother, he said, delivering the mug to her with a flourish. How very nice, she said. You're such a dear, Perrain.
I live but to serve, he said a bit grandiosely. He brought fresh figs and a slab of cheese to the table, then set the smoking pan in the center of it. You've missed your calling, my friend, Sparhawk said.
I learned to cook for myself a long time ago. I could afford a servant, but I don't trust strangers.
He sat down. Be careful out there, Sparhawk, he cautioned as they began to eat. Eresham's followers are a bit limp between the ears, and they're all obsessed with the idea of catching some neighbor committing a minor transgression. Eresham preaches every evening after the sun goes down, and he manages to come up with some new prohibition every night.
What's the latest one? Sparhawk asked.
Killing flies. He says that they're the messengers of God.
You're not serious.
Perrain shrugged. I think he's running out of things to forbid, and his imagination is severely limited. You want some more of this mutton?
Thanks all the same, Perrain, Sparhawk said, taking a fig instead. But one chunk of mutton is my limit.
One chunk a day?
No, one a year.
Chapter 22. The sun was turning the western sky a rusty color when Sparhawk and Sophrenia entered the square near the center of Debauer, and the light reflecting from the late afternoon sky bathed the walls of the buildings and the faces of the people in the square with a ruddy glow. Sophrenia had her left arm bound up in a makeshift sling, and Sparhawk held her other elbow solicitously as they walked.
It's right over there, he said quietly, nodding his head toward the far side.
Sophrenia drew her veil a bit tighter across her nose and mouth, and they moved through the crowd milling around in the middle of the square. Here and there along the walls of the buildings leaned hooded nomads in black robes, their eyes alert and filled with suspicion as they peered at every face that passed.
True believers, Sparhawk muttered sardonically, ever alert for the sins of their neighbors.
It's always been that way, Sparhawk, she replied. Self-righteousness is one of the most common and least attractive characteristics of man.
They passed one of the watchers and entered the smelly shop. The apothecary was a chubby little man with an apprehensive expression on his face.
I don't know if he'll consent to see you, he said when they asked to speak with Dr. Tangen. He's being watched, you know.
Yes, Sparhawk said. We saw several of the watchers outside. Please advise him that we're here. My sister's arm needs attention.
The nervous apothecary scurried through a curtained doorway at the back of the shop. A moment later, he came back.
I'm sorry, he apologized. He said he's not taking any new patients.
Sparhawk raised his voice.
How can a healer refuse to see an injured person? Does the oath they take mean so little to them here in Debauer? In Cypria, the physicians are more honorable. My good friend Dr. Voldy would never refuse his aid to the sick or hurt.
It hung there for a moment, and then the curtains parted. The man who thrust his head out between them had a very large nose, a pendulous lower lip, jutting ears, and weak, watery eyes. He wore the white smock of a physician.
Did you say Voldy?
He asked, in a high-pitched nasal voice.
Do you know him?
Of course, Sparhawk replied. He's a small man who's going bald, and he dyes his hair. He has a very large opinion of himself.
That's Voldy, all right. Bring your sister back here, and be quick. Don't let anybody outside the shop see you.
Sparhawk took Sophrenia's elbow and escorted her back through the curtains.
Did anyone see you come in?
The big-nosed man asked, nervously.
Any number of them, I'd imagine, Sparhawk shrugged. They line the walls of the square like a flock of vultures, trying to sniff out sin.
It's not safe to talk that way in Debauer, my friend,
Tangen warned.
Perhaps. Sparhawk looked around. The room was shabby and was piled high in the corners with open wooden boxes and stacks of books. A persistent bumblebee batted its head against the single, dirty window, trying to get out. There was a low couch against one wall, and several straight-backed wooden chairs and a table in the center.
"Shall we get down to business, Dr. Tangen?" he suggested.
"All right,"
the physician said to Sophrenia.
"Sit here, and I'll have a look at that arm."
"You may if it's going to make you happy, doctor,"
she replied, taking the chair and removing her arm from the sling. She pulled back the sleeve of her robe to reveal a surprisingly girlish arm. The doctor looked a bit hesitantly at Sparhawk.
You understand, of course, that I'm not being forward with your sister's person, but I must examine her.
I understand the procedure, doctor.
Tangen took a deep breath
and then bent Sophronia's wrist back and forth several times. Then he gently ran his fingers up her forearm and bent her elbow. He swallowed hard and probed at her upper arm. Then he moved her arm up and down with his fingers lightly touching her shoulder. His close-set eyes narrowed.
"There's nothing wrong with this arm," he accused.
"How kind you are to say so," she murmured, removing her veil.
"Madam," he said in a shocked voice, "cover yourself."
"Oh, do be serious, doctor," she told him. "We're not here to talk about arms and legs."
"You're spies," he gasped.
"In a manner of speaking, yes," she replied calmly. "But even spies have reason to consult with physicians once in a while."
"Leave at once," he ordered.
"We've just got here," Sparhawk said, pushing back his hood. "Go ahead, sister dear," he said to Sophronia. "Tell him why we're here."
"Tell me, Tangen," she said. "Does the word Daristim mean anything to you?"
He started guiltily and looked at the curtained doorway, backing away from her.
"Don't be modest, doctor," Sparhawk told him. "Word's been going about that you cured the king's brother and several of his nephews after they'd been poisoned with Daristim."
"There's no proof of that."
"I don't need proof. I need a cure. A friend of ours has the same condition."
"There's no antidote or cure for Daristim."
"Then how is it that the king's brother still lives?"
"You're working with them,"
the doctor accused, pointing vaguely out toward the square.
"You're trying to trick me into a confession."
"Them who?" Sparhawk asked.
"The fanatics who follow Arisham. They're trying to prove that I use witchcraft in my practice."
"Do you?"
The doctor shrank back.
"Please leave," he begged. "You're putting my life in terrible danger."
"As you've probably noticed, doctor," Sophronia said, "we are not Rendorish. We do not share the prejudices of your countrymen, so magic does not offend us. It's quite routine in the place we come from."
He blinked at her uncertainly. "This friend of ours, the one I mentioned before, is very dear to us," Sparhawk told him, "and we'll go to any lengths to find a cure for this poison." To emphasize his point, he opened his robe. "Any lengths at all." The doctor gaped at his mail coat and sheathed sword.
"There's no need to threaten the doctor, brother dear," Sophronia said. "I'm sure he'll be more than happy to describe the cure he's found. He is a healer, after all."
"Madam, I don't know what you're talking about," Tangen said desperately. "There is no cure for Daristim. I don't know where you heard all these rumors, but I can assure you that they're absolutely false. I do not use witchcraft in my practice."
He threw another quick, nervous glance at the curtained doorway.
"But Dr. Voldy and Cypria told us that you did, in fact, cure members of the king's family."
"Well, yes, I suppose I did, but the poison wasn't Daristim."
"What was it, then?"
Porgota, I think."
He was obviously lying.
"Then why was it that the king sent for you, doctor?" she pressed. "A simple purge will cleanse the body of Porgota. An apprentice physician knows that. Surely it couldn't have been so mild a poison."
Well, maybe it was something else. I forget exactly."
"I think, dear brother," Sophronia said then to Sparhawk, "that the good doctor needs some reassurance, some positive proof that he can trust us and that we are what we say we are."
She looked at the irritating bumblebee, still stubbornly trying to break its way out through the window.
"Have you ever wondered why you never see a bumblebee at night, doctor?" she asked the frightened physician.
"I've never given it any thought."
"Perhaps you should."
She began to murmur in Styric as her fingers wove the designs of the spell.
"What are you doing?" Tangen exclaimed. "Stop that!"
He started to move towards her with one hand outstretched, but Sparhawk stopped him.
"Don't interfere," the big knight said.
Then Sophronia pointed her finger and released the spell. The buzzing sound of insect wings was suddenly joined by a tiny, piping voice that sang joyously in a tongue unknown to man. Sparhawk looked quickly at the dust-clouded window. The bumblebee was gone, and in its place there hovered a tiny female figure directly out of folklore. Her pale hair cascaded down her back between rapidly beating gossamer wings. Her little nude body was perfectly formed, and her minuscule face was so lovely as to stop the breath. "That is how bumblebees think of themselves," Sophronia said quite calmly. "And perhaps that is what they truly are. By day, a common insect, but by night, a creature of wonder."
Tangent had fallen back on his shabby couch, with his eyes wide and his mouth agape.
"Come here, little sister,"
Sophronia crooned to the fairy, extending one hand.
The fairy swooped about the room, her transparent wings buzzing and her tiny voice soaring. Then she delicately settled on Sophronia's outstretched palm, with her wings still fanning at the air. Sophronia turned and stretched her hand out to the shaking physician.
"Isn't she beautiful?" she asked. "You may hold her if you like, but be wary of her sting."
She pointed at the tiny rapier in the fairy's hand. Tangent shrank away with his hands behind his back.
"How did you do that?"
he asked, in a trembling voice.
"Do you mean that you can't? The charges against you must be false, then. This is a very simple spell, quite rudimentary, actually."
"As you can see, Doctor," Sparhawk said, "we have no qualms about magic. You can speak freely to us with no fear of being denounced to Arisham or his fanatic followers." Tangent tightly clamped his lips shut, continuing to stare at the fairy seated sedately on Sophronia's palm with fluttering wings.
"Don't be tiresome, Doctor," Sophronia said. "Just tell us how you cured the king's brother, and we'll be on our way."
Tangent began to edge away from her.
"I think, dear brother, that we're wasting our time here," she said to Sparhawk. "The doctor refuses to cooperate." She raised her hand. "Fly, little sister," she told the fairy, and the tiny creature soared once again into the air. "We'll be going now, Tangent," she said.
Sparhawk started to object, but she laid one restraining hand on his arm and started towards the door.
"What are you going to do about that?"
Tangent cried, pointing at the circling fairy.
"Do," Sophronia said. "Why, nothing, Doctor. She's quite happy here. Feed her sugar from time to time, and put out a small dish of water for her. In return, she'll sing for you. Don't try to catch her, though. That would make her very angry."
"You can't leave her here," he exclaimed in anguish. "If anyone sees her here, I'll be burned at the stake for witchcraft."
"He sees directly to the central point, doesn't he?"
Sophronia said to Sparhawk.
"The scientific mind is noted for that," Sparhawk grinned. "Shall we go, then?"
"Wait!"
Tangent cried.
"Was there something you wanted to tell us, Doctor?"
Sophronia asked mildly.
All right, but you must swear to keep it a secret that I told you this."
"Of course, our lips are sealed."
Tangent drew in a deep breath and scurried to the curtained doorway to make certain that no one was listening outside. Then he turned and motioned them into a far corner, where he spoke in a hoarse whisper.
"Darestim is so virulent that there's no natural remedy or antidote," he began.
"That's what Voldy told us," Sparhawk said.
"You'll note that I said no natural remedy or antidote," Tangent continued. "Some years ago, in the course of my studies, I came across a very old and curious book. It predated Ishan's time, and it had been written before his prohibitions came into effect. It seems that the primitive healers here in Rendor routinely utilized magic in treating their patients. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't, but they effected some astonishing cures. The practice has one common element. There are a number of objects in the world which have enormous power. The physicians of antiquity used that sort of thing to cure their patients."
"I see," Sophronia said. "Steric healers sometimes resort to the same desperate measure.
The practice is quite common in the Tamul Empire on the Darisian continent,
Tangen went on,
but it's fallen into disfavor here in Eosia. Eosian physicians prefer scientific techniques. They're more reliable, for one thing, and Alines have always been suspicious of magic.